This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Thanks, Bradley, and thanks, Sharna, for setting up such a lovely evening. Appreciate it a lot. An opportunity to spend a few moments learning with you and sharing some ideas with you. Somebody gave me this book today, so I haven't read it yet. But I've read the back cover. It's called, many of you might have come across it, The Monk Who Sold His Ferrari. Anybody read it? You've heard it, nobody else has read it. Apparently it's a must. Apparently everybody's supposed to be reading this. The Monk Who Sold His Ferrari. The Monk Who Sold His Ferrari is the story of Julian Mantel, a superstar lawyer whose out-of-balance lifestyle leads him to an almost fatal heart attack in a packed courtroom. His physical collapse brings on a spiritual crisis that forces him to confront the condition of his life and seek answers to life's most important questions. So there altogether is very important. We've spoken a number of times about the fact that, unfortunately, change comes only through pain. There isn't another way. The human, any organism, and the human being is no exception, does not change when it's comfortable. So comfort is the enemy of change. And because we live comfortable lives today, we've never lived in a more comfortable era than today. And never in history have so many people been so comfortable as today. And yet at the same time, as a result of that very comfort, never have so many people been so unhappy as they are today. We're living in a very hard time. We're living in an extremely strenuous and pressurized time. The type of diseases we suffer from, the kind of mental anguish that people suffer from. But there's a linkage between the comfort and the suffering. The suffering is emotional. The suffering is spiritual. Our souls are agonizing because our bodies are in comfort. It's a complete paradox. And that doesn't mean we go out looking for pain and suffering. But as we've discussed before, some of you with me have discussed before, the idea that pain, the word for pain in Hebrew is Yisurin. Yud Samach Vav Resh Yud Nun Yisurin, which comes from the word Sar, Samach Resh. And Sar means to turn direction. Yisurin brings a turn in direction. What's another word that comes from the same root? Musar. Musar is self-inflicted pain. That's what Musar is. Musar is self-discipline. Musar is the pain of change that we compel ourselves to make. So now we have one choice. Either we compel ourselves through the process of Musar, and what Musar is a long discussion all of its own, or if we're lucky, Hashem brings pain upon us, or more likely we bring pain upon ourselves. If we're sensitive, sometimes we're just not sensitive enough to feel the pain. You know, if you bang your finger on the door, you close the door on your finger and it really hurts, you're lucky it really hurts. It means you're alive. It means you won't do it again. If a person didn't have feeling in his finger, he would bang the door on his finger again and again and again, and eventually his finger would become damaged. He wouldn't have a finger. So the pain that we feel when we mistreat ourselves is the pain that causes us to make adaptions, to adjust. And the same applies with the pain of illness, and the same applies with financial loss, or with the loss of a loved one, or with a marital breakup, with emigration. These are all cases of pain where the human being goes through suffering. Now, we can cover the suffering up and pretend it's not happening and carry on coasting, or we can deal with it. The Western tendency is to pretend it doesn't exist. Let's be strong, stiff up a lip and carry on, keep on marching. And that's great, that's fine. You don't feel the pain. But who wants not to feel pain? In the Eastern tradition, there is much more of a focus on managing pain by getting right into its center, not by avoiding it, by getting right into its center and feeling it at its center. Because once you feel it as a center, you're likely to figure out why it's there. And in Eastern philosophy, when you figure out why it's there, it's not just it's there because, you know, God forbid I've got cancer because I'm smoking. It's not that. It's a whole lifestyle. And if you get into the center of your pain, whether the pain is emotional, pain can be an argument you've had with somebody. The pain can be a rebellious child. The pain can be, as we said, a marital breakup, a business deal that went all sour and wrong. The loss, an act of crime. Anything can cause pain. But the tragedy is that the Eastern philosophy lives with bitachon, and Western philosophy does not. Bitachon means trust in God. Bitachon means believing that things are not coincidental. All of Eastern philosophy makes that assumption. Nothing is coincidental. So if you're feeling pain, there's something you've got to repair. Western philosophy doesn't think that way. Now ask ourselves as Jews, do we function? Not firstly, how do we function? And secondly, how ought we to function? Do we function East or West? As Jews living in South Africa, what do we do with pain? Either deny it or there's an act of crime, I better emigrate. Ill, we go to the doctor. So how do we function in the West? We function in a Western way, which is understandable. In the East, they naturally function in an Eastern way. If you're suffering some pain, you get into yourself and you figure out, you try and work out what's going on. How should we react as Jews? When Hashem says, Ani Hashem Rofecha, I cure you. What does that mean? I dish out prescription? I give drugs? Is that what God means when He says, Ani Hashem Rofecha, I am your healer? Means you'll find your healing in your soul, not in a drug. Find out what you're doing wrong deep inside you and make the corrections. That's the message. So I'm not suggesting there's various talks that we've had, some of you have participated in, that we all run up to India and become yogis. All I'm saying is that when you look at East and West, you realize that there's a whole lot of stuff that the West has dropped, and we have dropped it with them. That's the tragedy. It's only when you look at East and West that you realize what the West has dropped. If you just live in the West, you don't realize. And if we were living proper Jewish lives, we would realize, because we would be consistently Jewish. But we're not Jewish. There's nothing Jewish about the way we live. There really isn't. We just follow a religion, like the Christians follow their rituals and the Muslims follow theirs. We keep Shabbos and Kashrus and our wives wear shekels and we do all the right things and we go to Shiurim and we daven with a minyan. We do all the stuff. But we don't think like Jews. We don't operate like Jews. Something goes wrong, we look for the technical fix. We look for the mechanical solution. And sometimes you've got it. And the one doesn't deny the other. You've got to do both. But we don't do both. We only look for the mechanical solution. We don't even know how to look for the spiritual solution. Other than check if your mezuzah or something's wrong with your mezuzah. That's about as far as we go. Something went wrong, check the mezuzah. It's also mechanical. What does it mean, check the mezuzah? Check the mezuzah means check your heart. Do that first. Later on, check the mezuzah. Or maybe if you check the mezuzah, there'll be an indicator as what in your heart needs to be fixed. But what do people do? Ha! You know what? I checked my mezuzah, and you know what? The very word that there was a problem with, you know, I got tied up by a robber, and ukshatom was there was a letter missing. So you know what I've done? I bought a new mezuzah. Now I'm okay. No wonder I got attacked by a robber and tied up, because ukshatom was missing. That's not what's meant. What's meant, ukshatom missing means you're tied up in stuff. Untie yourself, or you're not tied up sufficiently. Whatever it is, means look inside you. But we don't. We just look at the superficial externalism. So my thesis to you is, we're not living as Jews at all. We're living Jewish rituals. We're living the Jewish religion. But we're not thinking the Torah way. And I'm not hearing a whole lot of shiurim and discussions around how to do that. How to make that shift. How to start living the Torah way. And this has nothing to do with orthodoxy or not. It's my son told me that Rabbi Goldfein's yeshiva, he heard a wonderful shiur on tape by Reb Moshe Gifter. Rabbi Gifter was asked to talk about orthodoxy. Where's Moshe? Diversity in orthodoxy. And he started off saying, you know, I can't really talk to you about orthodoxy because I'm not orthodox. And there's this stunned silence. And he says, because what does orthodox mean? You're either a Torah Jew or you're not a Torah Jew. There's no orthodox, non-orthodox. Other religions have orthodox, non-orthodox. What does orthodox mean? I'm not a Torah Jew, but being a Torah Jew means operating the way the Torah wants you to operate, running your life the way the Torah, examining things the way the Torah, seeing the world the way the Torah wants you to see the world. That's what it means. The purpose of learning Gemara is not to know another daf. The purpose of learning Gemara is to learn a thinking process that you can apply to everything you do all day. It's a method of viewing the world. It's a method of thinking. It's a method of analysis. I have a non-Jewish client. In fact, all my clients are non-Jewish, just about, in the United States. And he called me up one day and he said he's doing a PhD and he's quite intrigued by everything and he would love not to have to use me, but he can't, for all sorts of reasons. And every time he tries, and even when I went away now and I said, look, I'm going away for 8 weeks, is everything okay? They said, fine, we're okay now, you've set us on track, you know, go, we don't need you, it's fine. My office says he's been calling, when am I coming back? And when, so they try and manage without us all the time. They keep on trying. So he calls me up once and he says, can he come and see me? I said, you don't have to come and see me, I'll come and see you, because I like seeing the clients from their places. I can feel more what the problem is. He says, no, this time I need to come and see you. I said, fine, what's the matter? He said, I'll tell you when I come. I said, fine. So he came. He walks in, he says, where are the books? I said, they're in that room. He says, which are the books I need to study to know what you know? I said, well, let's first discuss your issue and then we'll discuss it. He says, that is the issue. That's what I've come to find out. What do you read? So I showed him the Shas. And I said, this is what I read. He says, what is this? And I explained to him. I said, this is a thinking process that allows you to analyze an issue in a way that no other methodology allows you to analyze. That's what Gemara is. Think like a Jew. Operate as a Jew. Interpret as a Jew. But to go around mechanically acting as a Jew and living as a Goy, all the external things are there. The yarmulke, the hats, the beards, the shaitels, everything's in place. The hearts, Goyish hearts. Not Goyish hearts when it comes to chesed, when it comes to kindness, when it comes to caring. That Jewish heart is always there. That's something that is inherent. That B'nai Yisrael, or B'ayishonim, B'nai Yisrael, that's just part of our genetic makeup. Kindness, but that's not our own choice. That's literally genetic makeup. We have certain humility, but we have kindness. That's our genetic makeup. But in the area of choice, of Yirah Shamayim, of operating in the world in a way that is a Jewish way, that we have choices about, my contention is we're failing miserably there. And I don't blame you, or I blame the teachers, the Rabbonim, us. Because that's what we should be teaching. The rest is not important. That's what's really important. If that's in place, everything else starts fitting into place. And we're failing you in that area. Anyway, back to what I'm saying, you'll see why I say this is really important. So here this guy, terrible pain, a brilliant lawyer, incredibly successful, has an almost fatal heart attack in a packed courtroom. A moment of desperate pain. What does he do? His physical collapse brings on a spiritual crisis. Ah, just what physical collapses are meant to do. To bring on spiritual crises. That's a time for celebration. When you're having a spiritual crisis set on by a physical hardship, throw a party. Because now there's an opportunity for change and growth. This is big stuff. This is really important. This is really big stuff. That forces him to confront the condition of his life and seek answers to life's most important questions. Hoping to find happiness and fulfillment, he embarks upon an extraordinary odyssey to an ancient culture where he discovers a powerful system to release the potential of his mind, body and soul, and learns to live with greater passion, purpose and peace. Now, what would we do if this happened to a Jew? God forbid, collapses, has a physical heart attack, which brings about a spiritual crisis, and he wants to get answers to life's most important questions. Where would he go? So we kind of know the answer. The mechanical answer is go to Yeshiva. Go to Israel, go and learn. That's the mechanical answer. But what chances are there of him really finding the way to release the potential of his mind, body and soul, and learn to live with greater passion, purpose and peace? That's what he needs to come away with. So this guy, where does he go? If he goes up to India, probably. I haven't read the book. I imagine it was that. Brilliantly blending timeless spiritual wisdom of the East with cutting edge success principles of the West, this inspiring tale shows you a step-by-step pathway for living with greater courage, balance, abundance and joy. Now that last paragraph, if I had to write a four-liner about the Torah, that's what I would write. Brilliantly blending timeless spiritual wisdom of the East, Aram, Avraham, Yitzchok, Yaakov, they came from the East, with cutting-edge success principles of the West, Ashkenaz, the Vilna Gaon, the Rishonim, the Achronim, this inspiring tale shows you a step-by-step pathway for living with greater courage, balance, abundance, and joy. That should be the Torah. And that should be your test all the time. Because here this poor guy has to go from America to India to become to find his spiritual source and to become spiritually centered. What are the Indians busy doing? What are they doing? They're busy trying to become like the West. That's what they're doing. You go there and you'll see how they're trying to become. What is China busy doing? Westernizing. So the West has suddenly said, oh, you know what, we've lost our souls, let's go to the East. And the East have suddenly said, we're not competitive, let's go and learn from the West. The only culture that knows it all is ours. We have everything that is in the East, we have everything that is in the West, because it all comes from us. Where does the West come from? From Christianity and its impact on science and knowledge. And where does Christianity come from? The Torah. And where does the East come from? From all the mystical sources that come from where the Zohar says, from the sons of Avraham Avinu. Where did they get it from? From Avraham himself. So Avraham is the originator of all forms of human self-development. The tools, the methods of self-development. And some went east and some went west. The Ashkenazim have got more of a west focus. The Asfarim have got more of an eastern focus. But we, by the nature, look at what we have as a religion. Just look at how the Torah is structured. Is halacha eastern or western in concept? What would you say? Western in concept. Why? It's measurable, it's exact, it's scientific. Kabbalah is Eastern. Gemara? It's a combination, if you learn it properly. Gemara is the point where it synthesizes. Gemara is the point where you learn to straddle East and West. I'm using the terms East and West because that's how the world kind of developed, but you know what I mean. I'm talking about an Eastern more mystical, more romantic, more spiritual approach to life, and the West, which is a measurable, outcome-oriented approach to life, a more of a mechanical approach to life. And we have both. There isn't another religion or culture in the world that gives equal emphasis to the mystical and to the mechanical, to the mathematical and to the poetic. It's not an art. It's not a science. It's the point where art and science intersect. It's not mysticism, and it's not Western religion. It's the point at which East and West intersect. It's not Kabbalah and it's not Halacha. It's the point at which Kabbalah and Halacha intersect. That's what we have. And people have to go, and that's, well, he's not Jewish, someone understands, but Jews are doing it too. They're off to India to find out the stuff that's in the Torah. And the Indians are off to the West to find out the stuff that's in the Torah. And we've got it all. And we're missing it. We're doing all sorts of things except accessing the one source of wisdom that this generation craves for more than any other generation before. This is the stuff of the 21st century. This is what everybody's looking for. How to blend the two. Not how to get the one and run back. And so he goes to India and he learns it. Then he goes back to America and he lives another chaotic life, about to have another heart attack, so he goes back to India. Backwards and forwards. I met a guy in India, a Jewish guy, is the chairman of the Chabad in Vienna. And he's in India 3 times a year, 5 weeks a time. Why? It relaxes him and he gets cleansed out and he gets his mind focused. And then, but what's the point? You have to go backwards and forwards? Isn't that what we're supposed to do every day? The way we daven shacharis, the way we put on our tefillin, then we get into the world, the way we keep the balance, get back into Minta, go in the afternoon, Ma'ariv, learn some Torah, comes a Shabbos. Isn't our whole life the ability to balance and navigate the two so that we don't have to run backwards and forwards? And some of the material that we're learning in the Nefesh HaChaim gives you a sense, because you know the mechanical side of Yiddishkeit, and the Reb Chaim Volozhin is you know, the Lamdan par excellence. He's the Talmudist, the author of this Sefer. Just to bring you up to date, those who haven't been part of the learning before, a couple of points, and then we'll go into some new stuff. He's been commenting, the real point that Reb Chaim Volozhin has been working around are two ideas. The one is that when it uses the words at the beginning of the Torah that God breathed the breath of life into man, that God made man in his own image, the word it uses for God is Elohim. That's one point. Elohim means master of all energy, master of all force. The second one is Vayehi ha'adam lenefesh chaya, and man became a living being. Those are the two phrases that he's really, that his first 10 or 12 chapters are spent explaining those two verses. And the fact that God created us in his own image, he explains as just as God is master of all energy forces in the world, in the universe, so he created us in his image means he empowered us with the controls of all the energies of the world. That's how great the human being is. God sits at the controls, God's the captain, the human being is like the co-pilot, and God says, take over, you fly the plane, all the controls are here, I'm sitting here. If anything goes drastically wrong, I may choose to intervene, I may not, that's my prerogative. You fly the plane, you can do what you want with it, all the controls are in front of you. That's what a human being is. We have the controls of the entire universe. We can build it, we can destroy it, we can expand it, we can contract it, we can uplift it, we can lower it, we can fly the universe. That's what the human being can do. And when it says in the Torah, "Vayehi ha'adam lenefesh chaya," and the human being became a living being, explains Reb Chaim Volozhin, that doesn't mean the human being became a living human being. Lenefesh chaya means the human being became the living soul of the universe. That's what happened. We are the soul of the universe. We drive the universe. We energize the universe. If human beings would stop generating energy, the universe would collapse. Not because God couldn't keep it functioning, but he wouldn't keep it functioning. He gives us the power to energize the entire world, and then he leaves it to us to operate with and to do. And therefore he says, I think in the section before the photostats that you've got, "Belazot lo levadon nitna mishpat habechira," and therefore only the human being has choice. "Lahatot atzmo ve'et ha'olamot le'ezitzad asher yachpotz." We can tilt the world and the universe in any direction we choose. We can bank the aircraft any way we want. We are driving it. And even if we've already destroyed part of the universe, we can rebuild it. We have mechanisms to do that. And you remember last week, that's why God is called our shadow, because God responds to us immediately and instantly. Move your hand, the shadow's hand moves. As we move, so the universe responds to us, and God accordingly. And that was the idea that we had, that if a human being functions joyously, he attracts joy. And what I find interesting about the East is not that they know anything that we don't know. I haven't learned anything from that source that isn't in the Torah. Not one thing. It's made me aware of things that I wasn't aware of before in the Torah. But more important is, they've come to it by research. So just as we get very excited when there's an indication in the Torah about a scientific theory, and then the scientists actually research and find it. So you know, the world, they thought the world was square, we know the world is round. So when the scientists discovered the world was round, oh, we were so happy. And all sorts of things that the scientists find, theory of relativity, and we find Chazal said that years and years ago, long before that, thousands of years before that, we get very excited. The scientists have discovered principles that the Torah took for granted. Well, just as scientific discovery is taking place in the West, so spiritual or psychological, or the research of the subconscious has been taking place in the West, in the East, and it's been taking place for 3,000 years probably, and it's documented. It's not as if they've just been, they've actually, it's documented. The research is phenomenal. So the way they get to an understanding of the subconscious is through thousands of years of observation. Try it. They try things and they record whether it works or not, and individuals try, and they keep journals of it, and groups of people. And one of the things they've tried is that a joy and a happiness attracts joy and happiness. And books and books and books have been written about it now in the West as well. And lots of people giving case studies of how it works and where it works. And that's in the Zohar, and the Chaim Volozhin talks about it and says, of course, you're putting out a certain energy, God gave you the controls. By putting out a joyous energy, you're sending out, by putting out a joyous face and feeling and spirit, you're putting out a joyous energy, and that goes up and that comes back down, and it starts affecting all the things around you. That's the way it is. You want to, you put out a successful energy, it affects all the things around you. It's interesting, we were commenting, some of us, Jeff Goffin and a few of us were listening to Rabbi Buchwald talk yesterday at Len Hazel Shul. And he's a typical American rabbi. Not typical, he's exceptionally good at what he does. But what was interesting about that talk, who was there? How many people heard him talk? That was a good Musa Shmuz. Was Musa, wasn't it? Was Musa about davening with Kavona. Was it oppressive or optimistic? It was incredibly optimistic. It was fun, it was optimistic, it was uplifting. Now, that is, apart from his own personal style, that is something that is very dominant in American culture. Americans don't like bad news. They're not interested in bad news. And you can't tell them bad news. And they don't believe bad news. They just refuse to believe it. Everything's going to be good. We are the best. We will win. I'm the best. I will win. Nobody can touch me. Nobody's like me. And that's drummed into them from little childhood. But you know what? It works. They do. Why? Well, there are many reasons. But one is, they put out an energy that is incredibly optimistic. Now, their leaders do it. Their people do it. They like to surround themselves with optimistic people. You won't get a job if you're a pessimist. You won't have friends if you're a pessimist. If you're a drudge and a drain, you're alone there. Nobody comes near you. It's infected. And they tell you, they warn you when you go to any kind of classes on anything. They say, get away from those people. The people who talk you down, get away from them. Now, the downside is they don't have Yisurim that easily. They avoid Yisurim. They live in a world of comfort. But the upside is they're putting out positive energy. Put out positive energy, the economy grows, things boom. They have their ups and downs as well, like anyone does. But far fewer downs than ups. And their ups are much bigger than the downs usually. It's just the nature of the people. They've learnt the art of being positive and what it does and how important it is. And we see in Torah that it's such a, that there is such a thing. If you put out panim seicha kois milamato, if you put out joyous faces down below, then God stands opposite you. Behe oros panim meirim kach meirim lo milamato. So God reflects the energy from above. V'im hume be'atzvus, and if you're going to be oppressed and depressed, nosin lo zed din kenegdo. God gives you depressive energy around you. You decide the energy. You want to be happy, you want happy people around you, you want a happy atmosphere around you, press the happy button. You're at the controls. You want to be miserable, you want to take a dive in the plane, push the stick down and dive. Hit the ground if you want, do what you want. You're at the controls. That's the human being. And that's the meaning of the Kiruvim. And then he goes into a discussion of the Kruvim. Remember the two angels that are modeled on the top of the lid of the ark of the Aron in the Mishkan, and they face each other, and in the second Beis HaMikdash they were at an angle, and he asks a question. Early on he asks, why were both, one of those angels represents the Jewish people, one represents God. So he asks, why are both angels at the same angle? God should always be facing the correct way, and the other angel should move depending on where the people are. But that's not what happened. What used to happen is that when the people were functioning well with each other and getting on well with each other, they faced each other, and when there was machlokes and there was destructiveness, they turned away from each other. Ask Subchaim Velozhin, the one supposed to represent God, why does he turn? The one that represents the people should turn backwards and forwards. But according to his principle, it's very simple. Any slight turn in the angle of the people, God reflects exactly the same way. He turns in exactly the same direction as we do. And so on page Lamed Bet, if you've got that in the sefer in front of you, that top paragraph, Omnam ha'inyan kamo shekatavnu, the matter is as we've explained, shehitchabruto yitbarach kebiyachol leholamot ba'akachot kulam, that God's attachment, so to say, to all the universes, to all the worlds and all energies in the world, all of them, v'chol sidreim v'itkashrutam, and all their systems and mega systems and their interactions with one another, the interface between the systems, as well as all God's systemic interaction and interface with us, that is determined by the measure of movement and energy that reaches them, all these worlds and universes and systems and interfaces that take place. The way God operates them is determined by the level of movement and energy that gets to them Mima asenu lemata, from our deeds here. We sit at the controls. And according to the measure of our movement and energy, not only do we impact on those universes, but if we're putting out a positive energy into that universe, the universe realigns itself positively and reflects that energy back to us with panim sochakot u'mesubarot, with faces full of smiles and laughter and acceptance and embracing. Therefore, gam hakruv shiramaz alav yitbarach shemo. Therefore, the angel on the lid of the ark that represents God, gam kein srichim la'amido metzudad ma'at. He also had to be at a slight angle. Kefi shiur hatzidut shel hakruv shiramaz aleinu mizeh hatan. Exactly the same angle as we are at, because the one reflects the other. God's angle towards us is exactly the same as our angle towards Him. The way we treat each other backwards and forwards sends out energies, God reflects, and so it is. But you begin to realize, and that's why I said, how far do you have to run? You don't have to run to India. Look what we've got. That we know how to, we have mechanisms for aligning the energies of the universe. And that doesn't mean you have to go to some Reiki expert in Calcutta. Each one of us can do that. That's what the Torah is. Each one of us can do that. And there are ways to learn how to. Now, I think when I've had various visions of what Gehenna is, of what hell is. They usually give me nightmares. But I've got a new one. My new one is when you get up there and you realize what a fun place the world was and what you could have done with it is, oh my goodness, did I have all that at my hands? And I did nothing with it. Such an opportunity. Imagine a kid that could have been playing in some arcades game thing, if that's what they like doing, and only realizes it's time to go home, what those machines are really capable of doing, and he's never going to get to come back there again. He's been messing around trying to do the thing he's familiar with. All of a sudden he realizes the brilliance of what can be done. He didn't get a chance to play. It's too late. I think that's hell. When we realize what a fun place this is, what energy and power is involved, what we could achieve by the little things, every little movement over here, what it does, and to think we missed it. What a tragedy. Why do that? And we came so close. We were from. We were involved in Judaism. We were going to learn. We were so close. But we simply made a mechanical routine of our Judaism, the same as the Muslims do of their Islam, and the Christians do of their Christianity, and the businessmen do of their business, and the engineers do of their engineering. We just turned it into another technique. Instead of really understanding the spiritual forces that are out of controls. And so he says at the bottom, skip the little word paragraphs and go down to the next one. Ba'et kriyat yamsuf, at the time of the splitting of the Red Sea, Omar hu yisparach l'Moshe, Hashem said to Moshe, Ma titzak elai daber b'nei Yisrael v'yisrael, why are you davening to me? Talk to the Jewish people and let them go. Move into the sea. What are you waiting for? Doesn't that sound lahavdil elef havdolos? Doesn't that sound like these Indian gurus are reputed to say, kind of, no, just do it and things will take care of themselves. Do a miracle. What do you have to stand in the way? Do you mean miracles don't happen? And somebody would come back from India and say, oh, you know what? This guru told me about this miracle. Open the Chumash. That's our stuff, not theirs. Where do you think they got it from? Miracles. Right, they invented miracles? Miracles is the Torah. And what does God say? Ratzonama, that means. Rav Chaim Volozhiner explains that verse. What did God mean when he said, don't talk to me, let them walk? It depends, the whole thing depends on them. And can you imagine if they wouldn't have? Let's play that out for a moment. Jewish people wouldn't have walked into the water, they would have davened, pouring their hearts out, tehillim, learning, tzedakah, chesed, they would have everything. All the women start taking on a shetel and a tichel. The men are now wearing their beards longer. People that didn't used to go to the mikveh are now going to the mikveh. They check all their mezuzahs. They change their mezuzahs. They're putting on two pairs of tefillin. They're doing everything. The sea doesn't split. Paro comes and wipes them out. A few were left over. What are those few going to say? Where was God? Where was God? Everything we did, the whole Shulchan Aruch we kept, and God wiped us out. Where was God? How can you believe in God after such a holocaust? God says, not the davening. What is it then? Dibidi who tell you milk? It depends on you. And imagine them coming to heaven. Imagine such a case. Let's play that scenario out further. So now, millions of Jews wiped out by Paro. Small group remain. They establish themselves somewhere or other and they start going. Eventually they die, they come up to Shemayim. And God shows them. All you had to do at the Red Sea, stop davening and start walking. And you would have saved 2 million lives. That's all you had to do. Can you imagine a hell worse than that? Tibidi, who tell you that? It depends on you. Sheimna. It's not just the walking. It doesn't mean just walk into the sea. If you want to try that, I have to tell you in advance. Go down to Muizenberg or to Durban, walk into the ocean, it isn't going to split. It's not going to happen. It's not only about walking. What is it? If they would be in full intensity of emuna and bitochen, belief and trust, and they would march ahead to the ocean, samuch libon lo yiro, their heart dependent on God without fear. That's the important point. If there's fear, then you're not in bitochen. They're completely relaxed because they know it's going to split. Then that action driven by such belief will put out an energy in the universe. That energy will split the sea. It's not God saying, I want to watch you. If you do this, I'll turn the button. No, it's God saying, you're at the controls. There's a formula. You want to split the sea? It's easy. There's a way to do it. I can't split the sea, says God. Not I can't, but I've programmed the world in such a way that I've withdrawn from it and given you the controls. And I've given you the instruction book.
So from inside, the tsunami was caused by man's negative energy.
So it would seem, doesn't it? It seems as if at the end of the day, and who knows where and what man, and where humanity was, but that's part of the suffering, that's kind of the pain that we have to look at and look inwards and try and figure out where we can be, but where we can be better. And so it is it happens sometimes God does intervene, sometimes there are things that are just completely supernatural and God has his reasons for it, and then we can't find any reason other than that, and that's what we assume. But our ability, so how far does our ability go? Our ability goes to the point where the human being is capable of splitting the sea. That's what the human being is capable of doing. And what force does he use for that? The force that he uses is emuna and bitach. So let's check emuna and bitochen. Emuna and bitochen is if a person rushes his davening so that he can get to work, what is he saying? What does he believe? What impacts his success? Not his davening. Doesn't believe it's the davening. And it's not even a question of rushing to davening, it's a question of where his head is during the davening, where his heart is during the davening, his sense of being settled during the davening. The level of fear and concern and worry, and very often we do that in the davening. We get into a worry stage as we go into, and I think that's one of the reasons that the tefillah is in the plural. It's so is not to get ourselves involved. If the davening would say in the davening, heal me, provide me with my living, then we would get involved very, very much into ourselves, oh, me and with my living, and heal me and all my pains and aches and all the rest of it. We would get very self-involved. But for Ainu, it's about the world, it's about the Jewish people, it's about the nation, it's about the world as a whole. We're not talking about ourselves. Why? Because we're fine. We're not afraid. Davening is not done out of a position of fear, but out of a position of tapping into a relationship with Hashem which is so sound that we can depend on it. Bitocha means dependability. When you depend on something, you don't worry. When you depend on something, you don't lose sleep. Bitochen means dependability. Emuna means belief, but bitochen means dependability. And your measure of dependability is the extent to which you're tranquil. There you've got it. What are you going to search for? Greater passion, purpose, and peace. Peace doesn't mean you kind of opt out of life. Peace means in the hurly-burly of life. There's no fear and there's no tension. Not because you're spaced out, because you know that you're doing the right thing for the right reason with all your energy, and that what you're doing has a bigger purpose than your own selfish needs. You're diminishing the ego, you're doing things right on a much wider level than that, and God handles the rest. and you're able to relax. That's peace. V'zehu, and he goes on to say, L'sukosi, this is meant, what is meant by the verse in Shir HaShirim. L'sukosi berichvei paroi dimisicho rayosi. God says to the Jewish people, my beloved, I see you, I compare you to the horse of Pharaoh's chariots. What a very, not a very complimentary thing to say. Shir HaShirim is a model of romance. God, it's a very romantic book between God and us, but apart from understanding it on the level of God and us, it's also, if you want to learn how to romance, then Shir HaShirim is the model. So one would, you know, but on the other hand, I wouldn't say exactly telling your beloved one evening, that looking into her eyes and telling you, no, you just remind me of Pharaoh's horses. You just wouldn't go down for you. What does he mean with Tzelomah? What is the image? The Medrash says that the horses of Pharaoh followed the opposite of the of what the world's what the what nature what the law of the natural cause and effect. Shaharoichev man higlasus. Normally, the rider rides the horse and drives the horse. With a paro vechelod, in the case of Paro and his army, hasus hinhig esrochvoi kamoshe omru razal and shmos rabo. The horses led the riders. Kein dimisicho behim shalticho rayosi. That is how I see you, my beloved, says God. Al zeh ofen mamish, exactly that, like that. She'apsha ani roichev arovis, even though I am the rider of the universes, im kolze kibiyochol atman higo oisiyad yedei ma'asayich. But things are reversed. I'm God, I should be running the world, but you know what? The horse is running the world, the horse is running God, you! You running me! I'm not running you, you running me! So it comes back to your question, Bradley, well, we've got to keep on saying, instead of where was God, where was God, where was I? It's true I'm the horse and I have a rider, but I'm like the horse of power. I ride my rider. And if I'm not getting ahead, if I'm losing the race, the question is not where is the jockey, where is the horse? Why aren't we driving? Why aren't we riding? Shinyan hitchavrusi kibyochel ha'olamos, because the way that I have attached myself to all the universes, hurak kifi inyan hisoyrus ma'asayich la'an motim. I run the world by your deeds. The direction you point the world in is the direction I lead the world in. V'zeh sh'omar akosuv roichev shomayim be'ezrecho. And that's in Dvorim, where Moshe Rabbeinu says that with your help, that with the your help, O Jewish people, I run the world, I run the heavens. V'chein ma she'omru ha'avoido tzorech gavoyah. The Gemara says over and over again, and it's, people kind of skip over it without really understanding it. Ha'avoido, the service of God, tzorech gavoyah, is needed by God. God, and again, how does God need anything? No, he doesn't theoretically need anything, but he chose to program the world in such a way that he would operate it as if he needed us. And the things we do, he needs in order for him to accomplish his plan. He needs us to do certain things. And if we don't do those things, the plan doesn't get acted out. It's in our hands. Although he designed the plan, we implement the plan. And if we fail in execution, the plan isn't implemented. There's no outcome. And then we say, where is God? God's waiting. God's given us these controls. He's waiting and he's there for us. This is some level of understanding of how great a human being is. What a human being is. And some of this is the individual and some of it is the nation. Some of it is a tzibur and some of it is a yochid. But whatever the case is, to realize what we're able to do. We tend to look at the world in terms of the energies flowing to us. And we look up and we ask God for things and we complain about things and we wait for things and we cry about things. And what we're learning here is that the initiation of flow is from us. Yes, it comes back. But all that comes back is what we send up. Well, it comes back bigger, it comes back stronger, it comes back more powerful. But all that comes back is what we send out. You know, it's like when they send out these radio signals to test whether there's anything out there and to measure distance, and they come back and the only signal that can come back is what you send out. Nothing else comes back. We're sending out signals all the time. We're sending out energy all the time, and we can manage that energy. We can move that energy. We can send out positive energy. We can send out negative energy. And that's one of the beautiful things about nighttime and morning. Sometimes we just don't get it right. But isn't it amazing how you can have a bad, miserable day and you can wake up the next morning fresh and ready to go again? We have the ability, even in the middle of the day, in the middle of a moment, we can turn ourselves around. But sometimes we don't. But certainly every morning we can. That's the power of the human being when you start becoming tuned into that and you start understanding what every action is. Every little action, whether you're talking about the big mitzvahs or you're talking about little interpersonal actions and reactions and what it is to send out a positive energy. And the little things, just the expressions on our faces, the way we feel, our feelings, just to go about things in certain ways. And again, these things have now been studied and documented from a research perspective. They haven't been explained. Nobody's explained the power of positive thinking. That it exists. People have documented it. Nobody's explained why posture, the way you hold yourself, the way you walk, the energy with which you walk. Nobody's explained why things really work the way they do and the enormous power of that to impact outcome. But we know that it is so. And it's something that we need to, you find it now being studied and documented and used in all sorts of areas. It's not only in the areas of moral and immoral things, right and wrong. That's of course the strongest area. When somebody's doing something wrong, when something is ego driven, and every wrong thing is ego driven, every avera that we do, whether it's a technical avera or it's a moral avera, it's all ego driven. And that's energy draining. Anything that is ego driven pulls energy away from the world. Anything that is non-ego driven, that is driven by a sense of self and soul, adds energy to the world. And the Torah gives us exactly how and what to do. But it's even in simple things, and we've touched on this at times before. Even simple things now, that in things as simple as interior decorating, their colors, they've documented the impact of paintings that have upward moving images or downward moving images, trees with branches up or trees with branches down, drooping flowers or flowers up. Little things that you would never believe have impact on people's well-being. All this has been well documented. The capacity, and we are so sensitive. God has made us so sensitive. We are the finest instruments in the entire universe. We react and we respond to everything. The more sensitive we are, the more we're aware of it. Mostly we're not even aware of it. That we respond to people, we respond to color, we respond to sunlight. Don't we know what's the syndrome called? People get depressed when the days get shorter, or when it's overcast and dark and there isn't sunlight. We get depressed. It's a clinical condition that is documented, and they've created artificial lighting and things to make people feel better. What does that mean? The fact that there's sunlight outside makes me feel better. Why would that be? It's energy. The sun is a source of energy. Take the sun away, there's no energy. At night time we try and create a different energy, but in the middle of the day where you haven't got the nighttime energy and there's no sun and there's only an overcast kind of presence, there's a negative energy, and people have to figure out what to do with it. So how do people in a place like London do it? How do they live? So the people who ignore it get miserable. They become miserable. What they do is the culture. They go to museums. They live a very rich cultural life. You'll find very often in cities where there isn't positive natural energy, there's a very rich cultural life. Where there's a very rich natural energy, where the sun always shines, there's not so much of a cultural life. They don't need it for energy. I'm not talking about Johannesburg. People gravitate towards sources. They thirst for sources of energy. It's very seldom that a movie gives energy, provides energy. It's very seldom. It can entertain, which is really entertaining. What is escapism? What does that mean? Why do people need to escape? What are you escaping from? From? Well, from Yisurin, from discomfort. If you were comfortable, you wouldn't have to escape. So you escape from discomfort. The discomfort might be boredom, or the discomfort might be something you don't want to think about, or something you don't want to confront. So people go to movies for escapism, and it works well for that, but it seldom gives energy. But if you compare the way you feel in a theater watching a live performance compared to a movie, the actors usually aren't as good on the stage, it's not as dramatic, all the special effects are absent, but the energy is much greater. Why is that? Because people give energy, not technology. There's no energy in technology. Technology is a drainer of energy. It doesn't give energy, it drains energy. I'm not saying we don't have to use it, we have to use it. But it's a drainer of energy. Technology gives nothing out, absolutely nothing out, only negative energy. People give positive energy. And art gives positive energy, because art is the projection of an artist's energy and emotions. But very seldom is it in technology. And people crave for that. People understand that. People go for that. But in our own lives too, in every part of our lives, we need to look at that, and we need to feel that, and we need to be conscious of that, that every little action we make has massive reverberation. And that's not intended to make us all pessimistic and worried and self-conscious. Not at all. It should exhilarate us and realize our power and our energy and how much we need to do in order to keep ourselves feeling positive. And the way you keep yourself feeling positive is not by saying you must be positive, I must be positive, I must be positive, think positive, be positive. That's not the way. It's by doing positive things. It's by attaching yourself to positive forces, to other people who are positive. That's when you learn a piece of Gemara really well and really thoroughly, and you suddenly get it and the lights go off and everything connects up. That's energy. That's an explosion that drives you. And to a much lesser extent in works of art, you read a beautiful poem, or you go to a piece of beautiful theatre, or you read a great book, it's written magnificently, the style, it's not only the content and the story, but where every paragraph is just so perfect, it's just so beautiful, and it energizes. You get to know what energizes you and what doesn't, what uplifts you and what brings you down. And you've got to attach yourself to the things that uplift and detach yourself from the things that bring you down, so that you can be constantly energized yourselves and put out that kind of a positive energy that has this effect on the world. In the mitzvahs that we do, in the chesed that we do, in the Torah that we learn, at all times, doing it with such positivity and with such enthusiasm and with such an understanding that this can change the world. This little action that I'm doing right now can send out a force of energy capable of impacting radically on me, on the people close to me, the people a little bit further away from me, and who knows how far, even far, far beyond that, on the well-being of the entire universe. So let's leave it there. If you're interested, we can pick it up next week and go a little further. But if there are a few questions now before we close off, I'll be happy to deal with that. Because Talmud Torah is the capacity of the human being to immerse themselves completely in a force of energy. Everything else you can attach yourself to energy, but when you learn properly, you're immersed in it. It surrounds you. You are in it. Like Eretz Israel does the same thing. When you're in Israel, you're in a force of energy. Okay. Yeah?
Men seem to have more opportunity, as you said, all the davening, to redirect and re-mute themselves and learn more. Women sometimes know when she's making a kosher meal, what she's doing, the Hebrew homework. But how does she infuse this thing while the men almost have set times to do them? She's just hurrying around.
And I think it's exactly the opposite. When the woman is preparing food in the kitchen, what is she doing? You can put a positive energy into the food, and you can put negative energy into the food. Everything that she does, the whole idea of kashrus, the whole idea of kashrus is a force of energy that goes into the food, and she's meant to be aware of that. That's an avodah too. That's a service of God too. The reason she's preparing, if you just go and buy food from the shelf, there are people who don't. There are people who don't buy processed food, not just for health reasons or kashrut. They don't because there's no energy in it. It comes from an industrial thing. It's empty. It's empty of energy. Whereas if a woman at home creates a meal with love and dedication and meaning, what energy there is in that food, what nourishment there is in that. So there's a whole world of energy. When she's dealing with her children, she's not doing homework with her children, she's nourishing her children, she's energizing her children. And that's how that relationship, if she isn't doing that, they're draining her. So she's got to learn how to energize her children and not be drained. So on the contrary, a woman is involved in energy stuff all the time, and in Kedusha all the time. A poor old man has to go off and work, so he needs to come back and learn and do daven and do the things that bring him back. But a woman, if she's attached to her core, is doing it all the time. I think you wanted to ask something.
Is there a form of, you mentioned that Hashem gives us the control of the vehicle and do with it as we please. But if you look at nature, the elephants will destroy a tree to a certain point, and then they will be removed from that area, and it will regrow. You won't allow us to destroy what he's created. So there must be checks and balances.
So usually that is so, and that's when pain and suffering comes. Sometimes when we do negative acts and we're destroying the world, in the process we get destroyed in the world, the self-destruction. And we start getting the messages. When you're doing something destructive, you start getting messages. You get a pain in your arm, you get a headache, you get a migraine, you get a this. Those are all messages that you're doing something, you're missing, you're doing something wrong. And you need to realign yourself.
Okay. And there's a phrase in the same chapter, there's an Islam that we have a shame, we are done at the other. So that's the team opposite to what Mera said, that rather than us, you know, let Hashem sort
of. Why is it opposite? Why?
It's saying that we'd rather be in the hands of Hashem and let Hashem have the control than the Yaradam Alekhana. I don't
want to fall into that. Being in the hands of Hashem doesn't mean that Hashem has the control. That means that Hashem guides me. That Hashem gives me that I'm not being manipulated by man, I'm being manipulated by God. That means if I get a pain, let me look at God. I must realize God has done this, not some other human being. If I've had a bad experience with another human being, the problem isn't the human being, the problem is me. This is another area that in the New Age stuff that's being written, huge research done on that, on when you're having a problem with another person, inevitably, the problem is not in them, the problem is in you. And what you see in them, you will find in yourself if you look deeply enough. A person is where we've got it, but documented stuff. So we've got Chazal, but we don't believe Chazal. I'm showing you. We just don't believe it. The fact is because we don't live that way. We don't take it seriously. We don't believe the very Torah we practice. Because we don't change the way we think. But they research it. So when you start seeing documented research and you realize to what extent that is so, having another problem with a person, it's exactly the same as when you know, the kid that bangs their head on the table and hits the table. That's what we do all the time as adults. Bang your head against another person, you hit the other person. If you're banging your head against anything or anyone, it's a message to you. You're doing something wrong. Because if you weren't doing something wrong, if he was a bad guy and you were doing nothing wrong, God would keep him away from you. If you've butted heads, it's because there's a message for you. God is talking to you. He's trying to point something out to you. Look inside yourself, find the flaw, fix it and move on. And this is not about getting all nervous and all, what does this mean and what's the meaning of that? It's just a steady process of getting to know yourself a little better and being able to look in yourself, getting rid of ego, understanding yourself and who you are, and the joy when you find it. The joy when you suddenly realize what's happening and you start to make the corrections and you start finding you're not batting up against people in the same way. On the contrary, things are going easier. The joy. That's what the Avodah is. That's what Musa is. That's what Torah is. Working, that's what Avodah means. Working on ourselves, working on our relationship, on the interface between ourselves and the world, on our interface between ourselves and God, and working on ourselves within ourselves.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. It's interesting that when you've got this batting up against somebody else, the other one's also got the batting up from it. So he also has to be doing exactly, and that's probably if you're focusing outward, what can you give to that person as opposed to what can I from that person,
both to give. Yes, but although you're right that the other person is experiencing that is also batting up, but his experience of you is likely to be different from your experience of him. So he's batting up in you in the things that he's got weaknesses in, and you're batting up against him in the things that you've got weaknesses in. Fix yourself. Accept upon yourself, you won't change anybody else. That's the moment when Rabbi Saul Salanta said it's harder to change one middle within yourself than to learn the whole of Shas. He wasn't exaggerating. And if it's so hard to change yourself, do you know what it is to try and change somebody else? So give up. You're not going to change your wife. You're not going to change your children. You're not going to change your husband. You're not going to change anybody. But you can make huge changes in yourself that will change the way you experience other people. That you have full control of your interface with other people, but you have no control over other people. You can't control another human being. So give up. Don't waste your time. It's unpleasant. Stop trying to control them. Control the interface. And you control the interface by controlling yourself. It's a justification for the religious Zionists. But the irreligious Zionists, we're not. Well, no, because
they might not have realized it, but they would make doing it as an act.
Yes, the only thing is part of doing this, it wouldn't work if you went to the sea and said, you know what, God's not splitting the sea, let us go and do it. That wouldn't have worked. So the secular Zionists were trying to do what they thought God was taking his time about. But the people who did it as an avodah, people who did it as a real religious belief, and did it al pi halacha, and did it properly. And then the big tests came, for example, Shemitah. That was the big test. So now you're doing it for Hashem. So what happens when you come to Israel and there's no produce and you've got to keep Shemitah? Now what do you say? Oh, we can't. What are we going to eat? Fear. If you're on fear, there's no bitachon. If one goes in and it's altaris hakodesh, you're doing it with absolute purity and al pi halacha, and you're relaxed about it. And if I'm going to be poor, I'll be poor. And if I'm going to be rich, I'm going to be rich. But right now, this is what I need to be doing. Do the right thing for the right reason with passionate energy and relax. It's as simple as that. Do the right thing with the right energy, passionate energy, and for the right reason, and just relax. Because from there on, God takes over. If God isn't taking over, it's either not the right thing, or it's not the right energy, or it's for the wrong reason. You know for sure, that is 100% sure, there's nothing else. If it's not working, it's one of those things you can check, and check deep inside yourself, because that's where you'll find the answers. It's both. Abundance is a spiritual concept, greed is not. So if abundance is a belief that there is a limitless supply, then it's spiritual. If the belief is there's a limited supply and it's a zero sum game and I've got to get as much of it as I can, that's physical, that's ego. Okay, thank you. Do we want to get together next Sunday?